When the world's first artists began putting paint to cave wall, they pretty much all decided to draw the same thing: animals. In fact, the first known figurative artwork was a wild pig found in a cave in Indonesia dating back over 45,000 years ago. Representations of animals, whether in Stone Age hunt scenes or Egyptian animal gods, run through the history of art. But what happens when the animal body itself becomes the canvas? And what does it mean for art to become entangled in the ethics around the creation of animal bodies?
I'm not the kind of artist who makes art to make people feel comfortable. I'm also not the kind of artist who is out to shock. But if people ask uncomfortable questions after seeing my work, then I think that's a better response than some sort of pleasant experience.
Artist duo Revital Cohen and Tervin Balin make film, sculpture and installations.
And we often think about the body of the animal and how that is shaped by the world and the context it becomes in.
They've made work with thoroughbred horses, bred their own batch of genetically modified goldfish, and in 2023, Somerset House commissioned them to make a new film for Channel, our online space for art, process and ideas. It was called May the Fox Take You, and it was commissioned in collaboration with UAL's Creative Computing Institute.
So we're also very interested in how animal stories can actually be stories about things that aren't animals, stories about larger systems.
In this episode, we join them as they research their next work, which continues to explore a question central to their practice. Can animal breeding be considered a form of sculpture?
I've always really loved animals. I grew up with dogs. Sometimes I kind of say that I was raised by dogs. And that really stayed with me. And I don't know, I feel that I'll always be drawn to some animal trace within.
Come on. Come on in.
I made a work called Pigeon d'Or, which was mostly a film that looked at the parallels between biotechnology and pigeon breeding.
How do you select which one?
Well, you're right. You look at the winner, try and pay your best to your best. Hoping they'll produce the best, but they don't always work like that.
No.
If crappiest pair you got, someone's produced the best racing bits. It's strange. I think it's the same with horse race, isn't it?
Yeah.
They pay fortunes for these horses to be covered by a top stallion.
I would argue that a pigeon is a created object because they're bred by people for a certain function, which is to come home quicker. So in some way, we could think of them as a biotechnology.
About 10 years ago, we started working on a body of work looking at the breeding of goldfish. We made a documentary following goldfish breeders throughout Japan. It was a very particular kind of goldfish called Ranchu. And we just spoke to particular breeders in competitions asking sort of, what are you trying to achieve? And mostly interesting for me were sort of conversations about attempting to make a fish look like a lion or like a kind of mythological creature. And there's something in the practice that I felt has more to do with sculpture or an art kind of intention than science or breeding. We were kind of at the beginning of attempting to breed our own goldfish, and we found Professor Atsuro Yamaha at the University of Hokkaido in Japan.
Sperm DNA extracted from the sperm, so we wash it.
So the work that we made is a series of goldfish, a batch of 45, produced for us with Professor Yamaha. And these fish, they have no reproductive organs at all. And therefore, when we made them, the question was, Can we then look at these animals and think of them as biological objects? It was kind of a provocation looking at how people put animals through these rituals when they commodify them.
And we've exhibited the living fish only once in an exhibition which we were comfortable that they would be able to provide the care for the animals. And the rest of the time, the fish lived with us in our studio. They all had names, and after more than 7 or 8 years, they slowly started dying, which was incredibly sad.
I think there was something there that really confronted us with the ethics of what we did and the question of, was it wrong? But then again, you look at goldfish that are sold for £1 in a pet shop and people take them home and they die after 2 months and are flushed in the toilet. If people took great offense to the work, I would always kind of say, but do you eat fish? That's something we don't even question. Ambiguity is part of what's interesting for me, I think.
At 2.5, the beginning of down in here. Come on, real good solid black type pedigree here. At 2.5 now. At 2.5, anyone down below here? At 2.5, who's got the 3.4 now?
Another animal that kept coming back in our work is the thoroughbred racehorse. And so we made a film called The Odds Part 1, in which one of the three parts of the film takes place in the Newmarket Equine Hospital. The film specifically focuses on the moment, which is called knockdown, of the racehorses going down on ketamine before surgery.
After the horse is anesthetized, they get tied up by the legs and pulled through a kind of system on the ceiling. It felt that this was kind of a moment in which the horse becomes a sculpture, that it becomes sort of inanimate and all you can see is just this gorgeous body being handled by people very lovingly, but it's still, there's something about it that looks quite aggressive, although it actually really is not.
I think another really interesting thing is the role that art has played in the thoroughbred. All these horse paintings are early forms of brand management for the brand, for the product that is the thoroughbred racehorse, which is also a product of the English Empire. In many ways, these practices, they say a lot about this country. At the moment, we're making a body of work looking at dogs, and very particular dogs. And so in this podcast, we really want to find out if we can consider animal breeding as a form of sculpture. And therefore, we're really interested in finding out more of when did the breeding of the dog shift away from breeding for function and towards breeding for form.
There is no other animal species in which size difference within a species is greater than in dogs.
We really wanted to talk to the historian Michael Warboys, who's written a lot about dogs in Victorian times in this country.
Before the Victorians, dogs were like the colours of a rainbow. They merged into each other at the margin, they bled into each other. At the end of the Victorian period, dog breeds were like the colours on a paint sample card. They are distinct, discrete. They started drawing ideal dogs, imagined dogs, on what they should be like, deciding this is what we're aspiring to. And if you talk to modern dog breeders, they all have in their mind an ideal of what this breed should look like. And although they've got 50 specimens in front of them, none of them is really quite right. This ideal is there, but it's a curious ideal because it's an ideal that they're always trying to improve.
There's so much to unpack in that answer. But I just want to go back a little bit to those Victorians and why it was that they were so interested in the form rather than maybe the function. And what is it that caused that shift?
The very first dog shows were held in pubs. And they might have had one in Manchester 1 week and then another one in London the following week. And the problem was that a dog might win in Manchester the first week and come last in London the second week. And so what they needed is they needed a standard for each breed. And they defined this by the form. And initially, the form was seen to be an indicator of function, but in time, form became an end in itself. Because the dogs being used, they were city dogs, they were pets. You see this most strongly in terriers. Originally, there was just a terrier. Terriers were dogs that went down holes and chased out foxes. By the end of the Victorian period, I think you have 17 terriers. It's rather a commercial process, you know, where you start off with one type of collar and then you get different brands of collar, where you started off with one terrier and then eventually you have different types of terrier. And one of the things that dog breeders did, in order to increase their market share, they would choose exaggerated features. And this is complained about by people, is that dogs become more exaggerated in their form. You know, they get longer hair, longer tails, their eyes stick out. Some of the Victorians described dogs as goggle-eyed monsters. Well, that's exactly what the critics of modern dog shows say.
This is so interesting in light of our interest in this idea that breeding is a form of sculpture. I was hoping you can tell us about some of the more sort of famous breeders of the era, the breeds they were producing.
Yeah, I mean, probably the most interesting one we came across is actually the Irish Wolfhound. The Irish Wolfhound is the national dog of Ireland. But in fact, the Irish Wolfhound was invented by an Englishman in 1865. There was a man called Graham who decided that he would revive the Irish Wolfhound. The story was that the wolf was hunted to extinction in Ireland in the 18th century. There was no need for this breed anymore, so it died out. But it had this mythical status of being the largest dog in the world. Graham decided that it would be great to have Irish Wolfhounds. He read all the books on the Irish Wolfhound. He looked at all the drawings of the Irish Wolfhound. The dogs that were most like Irish Wolfhounds were Scottish Wolfhounds. He crossed them with Great Danes to make them bigger. He crossed them with Tibetan Mastiffs to make them get their coats thing. He crossed them with Borzoi to make them more athletic. And in 1879, he turned up at a dog show with an Irish Wolfhound. And everybody's gobsmacked. But over time, this breed was accepted. You know, there are similar dogs. The Doberman Pinscher was bred by Doberman to look like an aggressive guard dog. It's a new creation. A breed was a brand. And so it became an industry, both in terms of the product, the design, and also in terms of a commodity which you could add value to by differentiation. There were also examples of people dyeing their dogs' hair, people altering their dogs surgically and shaving them and all kinds of things.
What was really interesting for me in what Michael was saying was this idea of kind of applying fantasy onto the body of an animal. What kind of causes people to look at another creature and decide that their body is the carrier of their sort of ideals? Even all this quest for a perfect form, there's something very strange about that. How can an animal be perfect, and where does this lead to? Going beyond the dogs, we wanted to speak to writer and curator Philippa Ramos to talk about looking at animals and how those images of animals has informed the ways bodies were created.
There's this film about Donna Haraway where she starts the film by saying that for a while she was obsessed with the way in which Americans are changing their teeth and the way in which American dentistry is just trying to create a certain aesthetics of how teeth look like and how all these teeth are arranged in a certain way. And then she realized that the model is classical sculpture.
Wow.
So once again is fiction, let's say, or art that is creating reality in a similar way to what a breeder decides to create a breed of dogs, let's say, the wolfhound, based on historical artifacts, based on drawings, based on narratives and artistic representations. So it's as if we by thinking something, we make that thing possible and make that thing real. No?
So we're so used to looking at kind of acts of creation when people make art, sculpture, video, writing. But I would really argue that animal breeding is a form of creation. And we've often been kind of thinking of particular moments of breedings as acts of sculpture. What do you think?
So there's this relationship with imagination and this relationship that the imagination may create reality. But then there's also the relationship with forms, no? With the fact that art is capable of generating forms, and that these forms then become desirable, and the idea of perfectioning, which breeding is also attempting to, and it was like creating an ideal. And what is this ideal of perfection, which is something that I also think often in relation to zoos, because zoos try to show, let's say, the most standard animals. You will never see a giraffe that is too short, or an albino ostrich, or it's really to show those animals that fit within the norm. And this norm is sculptoric, no? This norm is connected to a certain canon. And the forms of breeding are exactly those. And actually, it's also related to an economy. And for instance, those, I've heard these stories many times, like, oh, I got this dog or I got this cat. It was slightly cheaper because it was black and generally they should be brown. Or, oh, I got this dog because it was the smaller of the litter and generally the breeders want to have them bigger. No? So there is a standard, and the standard connects to an ideal, and this ideal is profoundly sculptoric. So of course there's a profound connection between the two, also in the basic idea of sculpture, that is revealing a form that exists out of something.
You've thought and you've written and researched a lot on animals and how we look at animals, how the animals are represented, not just in zoos but also in moving image. I'm interested in more examples of what the effect of that representation is on the animals themselves.
There's something that generally fascinates me, which is the relationship with the object, with a camera. For instance, if we were in this room and we were being filmed, I knew that if there was a camera here and I would look at the camera, I wouldn't be looking at the camera. I would be looking at what the camera does, and what I know that the camera would do. If there would be a parrot in this room, I think we'd have a completely different relationship to the camera. Because in the beginning, we'd probably just engage with the camera with curiosity or with a bit of fear, and so would relate to this object in a completely different way. Like in the beginning, maybe, is this alive? Is this not alive? Why is it making sound? And what is this light? And so on. And so I'm generally very interested in understanding the kind of relationships, specifically talking about artists who use cameras to engage with animals. I'm very interested in the potential relationships that exist in a sort of a triangle between person, machine, and animal, where the relationship between machine and animal escapes the control of the person, and they start relating to one another in ways that are not fully understandable. There is a film that this Scottish artist called Duncan Marquis made with a jackdaw, where there's the jackdaw who lives in a house, and Duncan Marquis is filming this jackdaw, and you see that the jackdaw is clearly engaging with the camera. I mean, now I will anthropomorphize and say that the jackdaw is making friends with the camera because this is the kind of relationship that my human brain understands. But whatever is happening there, there is clearly a relationship being built, at least from the side of the animal with the camera. No? And this for me is interesting because it opens for possibilities that are not completely dominated by us who believe we can always dominate everything. No.
Yeah. So you've spoken a lot, I think, about the zoo, and I'm also curious about how the zoo and our relationship with animals in the zoo reflect a kind of broader attitude towards the natural world and towards the other.
So I'm going to start with something that is not the zoo, but it's the Natural History Museum. I remember some years ago, I was in this Natural History Museum in Paris, in this alley, which is called the Gallery of Evolution, which is a very classical exhibition site, very monumental. You enter and you almost have a parade of skeletons. That are the first one, the leading one, is a human skeleton. And then it's followed by very large mammals. It's a very dark. And I was there, and there was this grandmother with this child. And I was like, how come this child is not terrified and running out of here looking at all these skeletons of animals? And this led me to think, this space, what it's doing is normalizing brutality, normalizing violence by rendering it into spectacle and framing it through education. No. And this to say that zoos do exactly the same thing. How come? And people nowadays, if we see pictures of zoos from like 1940s and 50s, you don't see that many children. You see a lot of adults. And nowadays, mostly people go to the zoos with children, you know, to entertain children. And how come these children are not terrified or disgusted by seeing these incredible animals behind bars? And zoos are trying to improve the conditions, but very often they're still in very poor and very small environments. And it's because spectacle just distracts us and makes us like a bit numb, and we willingly suspend our criticism, and we forget where we are, and we become mesmerized by the fur of leopard or by the way a flamingo is standing, and so on and so forth. And so these spaces of horror, of torture, of confinement, of isolation and of radical sufferance. Very often when there's all these conversations going on possibilities of having animal communication, of AI helping us to communicate and understand what animals are saying. And the other is thinking, do we really want to understand what animals are saying? I don't think people are prepared. Imagine entering a zoo, what animals would tell you if you could understand. Maybe they are not even speaking to you, because it's not like animals are always interested in communicating with humans, but what would they be saying to one another or to themselves by being captives for years and decades there? So, and we just ignore that. We suspend that awareness, and we just accept to be taken into this Disneyland where it's almost these animals become a fiction. They're not real anymore. They're a trope for an animality that is not there anymore, and it's regretful. I truly hope and trust that VR will replace zoos.
It's so interesting that you start from the Natural History Museum, because that is completely a place where I would say you can see how kind of sculptural animal bodies are or presented to be. I mean, we were doing a lot of work with historical taxidermy and dioramas in Natural History Museum, where they were made by people that have never seen the real animal, but were just given a skin, normally next to a kind of heroic imaginary story about how this animal was so monstrous and the hunter so brave. And then another person had to kind of create a scaffold to stretch the skin on and invent a landscape from which this animal would kind of come out of. So everything that's kind of is presented as science, as natural history, as facts, is also in many ways a human imagination.
Totally. Last month, I was visiting the Natural History Museum in Madrid, and there's an African elephant there. And I was there with this person who, by a strange story, is the grandson of the man who was a supposed naturalist who actually killed that elephant and brought the elephant to be taxidermized in Madrid. But what happened is that they left the skeleton and only took the skin. And it's the only elephant with testicles in history, because elephants don't have testicles. Male elephants, the testicles are inside the body. So it's actually quite difficult, unless you know their behavior. Like, female animals tend to be in groups, while male animals tend to be on their own. It's very difficult, apparently, to distinguish a female from a male elephant, African elephant. And this elephant in Madrid has testicles because they thought that the animals had testicles. No? And it's such a curious and funny, also sad, but very funny story how you create a fiction out of an attempt to make a very natural and realistic animal. No?
Thanks to Revitalin Ter, to Michael Warbois and Philippa Ramos. You can check out Revitalin Ter's film May the Fox Take You on Channel Now. The Process is produced by Alana Chance and presented by me, Laurent John, for Somerset House. The exec producer is Eleanor Scott. The theme music is by Carbeard. And the series is mixed by Mike Woolley. See you soon.